All across Wisconsin from Civic Media, this is Up North News Radio. Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. Here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
And welcome back to the second hour of Up North News Radio for this Thursday, November 10th. Coming up this hour, Joe Zepecki helps us figure out the ups and downs of the roller coaster that was the 2022 campaign and its results. Coming up tomorrow, Senator Tammy Baldwin talks to us about asking the U.S. Department of Education to go after predatory private schools that forced students into unnecessarily expensive loans. We'll have Courier Newsroom political director Carolyn Fidler, former Chicago Tribune editor Mark Jacob, and UW Eau Claire athletic director Dan Schumacher. That's all on the show tomorrow. To reach us, the email address is radio@upnorthnewswi.com, or you can call us 715-388-7155. You can follow us all day long, Up North News WI on social media, and upnorthnewswi.com is our website, where you can also sign up for our daily newsletter. And as I mentioned earlier, on the website, I will be posting an editorial later this morning about three takeaways from this week's election results, and then some things to watch for now that the election is past us. Amongst the reactions to the election, you have to include the winners and losers column from Dan Bice in the Journal Sentinel. And I'm going to start with one observation that was immediately pounced upon by a critic, basically, calling out the Wisconsin Elections Commission for the way that people were able to cheat and fraudulently obtain ballots. Now, in Dan Bice's view, it shouldn't have been that easy to get the fraudulent ballots, but it was. But that was pounced upon by one of my favorite people on Twitter, Jay Bullock, who also goes by the nickname Folk Bum. And he said through Twitter last night that Bice is infuriatingly wrong on the facts. He says the Elections Commission can only follow state law. They cannot make new laws saying what to require from people who request regular or military absentee ballots. That is spelled out in state statute, period. He notes that the people, Kimberly Zapata and Harry Waite, who fraudulently obtained ballots, could have gotten the same results mailing requests to clerks. Zapata could have gotten the same results walking into a clerk's office in person. And further, Bullock notes that the Wisconsin Elections Commission does not issue ballots. Any ballots sent in the name of fake soldiers or to Harry Waite's address were sent by local clerks who themselves were following the law. And Jay writes, look, I get that bashing the Elections Commission is the new hotness among Republicans, but the commission followed the law. If the law is flawed, there's nothing to blame the commission for. It's the notion of blaming the commission, he says, is incorrect and only fuels the one-sided election denialism that brought us January 6th and Tim Michaels, and that the whole provision shouldn't be there. Now, again, folks can agree or disagree with Jay or Dan Bice on that, but the fact remains we have had Republican control of the state legislature for 12 years. If there were flaws in election law before 2020 and Trump making all these wild claims about non-existent fraud, somebody could have caught it and fixed it. Frankly, that happens in legislative sessions every year, is that somebody sees something in state law and says, oops, that was an unintended consequence, or times have changed or technology has changed. And so, you know, they never get news headlines, but there are bills passed quite frequently that make these technical or cosmetic changes. And so if somebody noticed these, omissions, they could do something about it. Sometimes those changes, or rather those unintended consequences, are known on the front end. I'm sure at some point when it was decided that members of the military didn't have to show ID to require an absentee ballot, I am 100% certain that somebody at the time said, wait, that could lead to problems, but it went through anyway. And now, of course, that you can see somebody basically engaged in the crime of trying to use our military to prove fraud that doesn't exist. Now you have people saying, oh, well, the law is bad. The commission is bad. Well, no, just go and change the rules for the next time. There's nothing wrong with finding omissions and unintended consequences and repairing them. But that in no way, shape, or form tells you that the system itself is rife with fraud and therefore needs to be blown up. I mean, it appears that Doug La Follette wins a narrow victory as Secretary of State over the Republican Amy Laudenbach. But we knew what the worst case scenario was that La Follette loses, a Republican is in the Secretary of State's office, and then a Republican legislature and a Republican governor abolish the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission, put far too much power into the hands of either the Secretary of State and or the legislature to make up election laws on a whim and decide certifications on a whim, allowing them to pick the winners and losers and overturn the will of the voters. They would have done it with the encouragement and approval of people like Ron Johnson, Tom Tiffany, Scott Fitzgerald, and others. All of that could have happened. But right now, the system has worked. The Wisconsin Elections Commission is following state law. And if it needs to be fixed, then it's time for Republicans in the legislature to actually work with Governor Evers and make our elections, which are already good, even better. We'll hear from Joe Zepecki coming up in our next segment. First, this break. This is Up North News Radio. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins us now on this Election Day morning. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning. I'm excited. It's Election Day. We've been working up to this for a long, long time.
We really have. Can I assume you were among the hundreds of thousands of early voters or absentee voters in Wisconsin?
Yes, I early voted on the second day that one could early vote. I was on the University of Wisconsin campus at the time, leading a group of students over to the early voting location on campus, and it was exciting. There were a lot of people taking advantage of that opportunity, and I think once you vote early, you free up time that you're not having to make your plan to vote to help others.
And that's really where I was going to go next. Is today is really, you know, make a friend, bring a friend, kind of a day. And for those of us who voted early, you really do get to just reach out and make sure everybody gets that opportunity to vote. And I have a feeling, because of the big issue of 2022, I have a feeling that a lot of women who typically vote are going to find a friend who doesn't typically vote, and they're going to make a voting date together.
Yeah, I think you're right. The midterms obviously do not get as much attention as a presidential cycle will get. But this midterm in particular has so much at stake. With the Supreme Court this past summer having overturned Roe versus Wade, in Wisconsin, the meaning of that is that we revert to a law that was passed 1 year after statehood in 1849, which is a criminal abortion ban that would send doctors and nurses to prison. And it obviously has really, really severe health impacts on women in our state who, you know, we're already hearing these stories and they're frightening. So I do think that we are seeing a mobilization. And I do hope that today, on our last opportunity to weigh in the midterms, that people will be thinking deeply about the fact that this is one of the few times in our nation's history where we have seen ourselves move backwards in terms of rights and freedoms rather than forward. And so I know that's been part of my focus. I have a lot of things that I've been urging voters to be thinking about, but one of them is the fact that our motto is forward, and we should not be satisfied in having seen this this huge step backwards.
I've seen nothing to indicate that today wouldn't be like the special congressional elections and the Kansas referendum, in that a whole lot of people who either typically vote Republican, lean Republican, or don't have not voted at all are going to register because we have same-day registration in Wisconsin. I haven't seen any indications that that would show that the passionate feelings the Dobbs decision brought up have waned in any way. Have you?
I have not seen anything to suggest that they've waned in my activities, which involve a lot of rallies and, you know, bringing people together for the purpose of getting people out to vote. I will say that I am seeing a waning attention in the media, in the sort of national media, which disappoints me. Because I think it is such an essential issue. And frankly, I don't know that we've done a good enough job of telling the story of what this has meant in women's lives here in the state of Wisconsin or across the country. But it saddens me so much when I hear from somebody who lost due to miscarriage or ectopic pregnancy or something, a wanted child, and then had to wait to present and get any care until they were dying. And literally that's, you know, the only exception for our criminal abortion statute is to save the life of the mother. Not in cases of incest, not in cases of rape, not in cases of negative health impact. And so we're literally telling people, we can't help you until you appear to be about to die. And that's what's happening in the state. I don't want to be, it sounds fanciful when I say that. I have met women already who have had that fate.
It draws us to the contrast in the race that's on the ballot here to see who will serve with you in the U.S. Senate, whether it continues to be Senator Ron Johnson or Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. And I dare say, not to be all cliche-like on this, but there's hardly a greater study in contrast on the ballot.
That's for certain. It's hard for me to believe people don't realize that sometimes. But of course, I guess I'm up close all the time to study that. Well, let's start with the issue we were just discussing. The overturning of Roe versus Wade, and how we move forward as a nation. I co-sponsor a bill called the Women's Health Protection Act, which would codify Roe versus Wade and would prevent states like Texas with their vigilante law, and frankly, states like Wisconsin that have endeavored to pass some pretty draconian laws from doing so if it impacted a woman's health or life or. And so that measure came 2 votes short of passing, 2 votes short. So Wisconsinites, you have a choice. Do you want to send me another United States Senator who will join us in passing the Women's Health Protection Act? Or do you want to keep the current status as the law of the land? Or Ron Johnson is sponsoring for the 7th time a measure that would create a national criminal ban on abortion after 15 weeks. So that's your choice, right, on that issue. But then, in Wisconsin, we've always been about the economy and jobs. We make things in Wisconsin. We also grow things in Wisconsin. And with the infrastructure law, we're building things in Wisconsin. Johnson voted against the infrastructure law. Mandela Barnes is a huge proponent of not only fixing our infrastructure. He was obviously a part of the Evers-Barnes team that's pledged and is fixing the damn roads. But in addition to that, the focus on bringing jobs back to the U.S. that we, through really bad manufacturing and industrial policy over decades, allowed to happen. But now with focusing in on supply chains and the broken supply chains and beginning to fix that, we're bringing those jobs back, and we're at the very beginning of this. And I want a partner in the United States Senate in Mandela Barnes, who is helping us do that, not literally blocking those opportunities to bring our supply chains home.
You know, one of the awful words that's been used in this campaign is the word different against the lieutenant governor. But it reminds me that when you ran the first time in 2012, people said, can this, you know, different person from Madison really represent the state? And now we look at the rural broadband expansion that you've brought across Wisconsin. Recently, $10 million was announced for infrastructure work at the Port of Green Bay. So you've been able to prove your record. And yet when you hear Mandela Barnes described as different in this race, how does that strike you?
Look, we have been governed by a United States Senate since 1789, and there have not been many women, there have not been many people of color. I frankly believe, and I always have, that we are better governed when our legislative bodies, including the United States Senate, looks like all of us and has people who have experienced life like the rest of us. You know, there's a lot of my colleagues, both Republican and Democrat, who are multimillionaires and have, you know, some of them born with a silver spoon in their mouths, others, you know, have different paths to have gotten there. And then there are actually probably a minority in the United States Senate who, by grit and hard work and great family values and wonderful parents, you know, have gone up that step ladder step by step, working hard at every stage and get what the rest of us need to, you know, to go through in order to get ahead. That is probably the perfect difference between Mandela Barnes and Ron Johnson, is that, you know, Mandela Barnes, when you hear his family bio, his grandfather fought in World War II, came back to Milwaukee, started working at A.O. Smith in a union job, and made enough to lay a foundation for middle class life for his kids, who, you know, and then that's Mandela Barnes' parents' generation. His mom was a public school teacher. His dad worked third shift at an auto plant as a UAW worker. And they had a middle class life that provided opportunity for Mandela Barnes. He gets that, and he knows that he has to fight for those, you know, the public schools, for good union paying jobs, to give every other Wisconsin child, an American child, an opportunity at the American dream. And that's what he's about. And that's what I hope everybody embraces on Election Day.
And that's what we'll continue to watch as people vote throughout the day here. Senator Tammy Baldwin, so nice of you to visit with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, along with everything that we talked about with the senator, it is important to note that there are local races on ballots, such as sheriff's races, for example. But there are also referendum questions in school districts across the state. And there are, at last count, 81 different questions on the ballot from school districts across Wisconsin. 39 of those 81, so about half, are capital referenda, you know, looking to fund construction and maintenance projects. And, you know, that's to be expected. Schools need updating, fixing, repairing, building. But more than half, 42 of them, are operational referendum questions just to fund staffing, utility bills, things like that. And if all 42 of those pass, that's going to mean higher property taxes around Wisconsin to the tune of $360 million just to fund operations at schools, when the state has a surplus of $5 billion that Republican legislators have sat on, something that Governor Tony Evers has put out a plan for. keep that in mind in the voting booth as well. On this very important election day, here's a public service announcement from Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar all about it.
And we're just reminding everyone, you have great ways to vote in Wisconsin, and all you need is your photo ID, and you can same day register. You can also still use your absentee ballot. They've got to be in by 8 p.m. on Election Day. On Election Day, November 8th, polls open 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. And you can always try to beat us on how many people vote in your neighboring state of Minnesota. We welcome the challenge, so get out there and vote.
Welcome back. This is Up North News for a Monday, day before the election. Although hundreds of thousands of us have already cast our ballots and many more will tomorrow. Polls open at 7 a.m. They close at 8 p.m. If you need to know where your polling place is, go to myvote.wi.gov. Joining us now is a national correspondent for Courier Newsroom, who puts together marvelous explainer videos for us that you can find on the Up North News social media channels. And that's Alan Piper. Alan, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Alan, if you're familiar with the Now This news videos that are on social media, Alan worked there for quite a while before we were able to attract him to help produce similar videos for us. Alan, for those folks that, how would you best describe your video work and the explainers that you do for the Courier Newsroom outlets around the country?
Well, I do a biweekly series called Three Key Facts that takes an issue that is important to the state of our national politics and tries to break down the three most salient points and hopefully drive people to do more investigation homework on their own to learn about the rest of the issue. And I think both in terms of my work with Courier and at Now This, social media short form video is a great way to get some basic information to people. It is a starting place for educating yourself politically. And I think that the outreach that we did, particularly to young voters, played a significant role in both the 2018 and 2020 elections in driving record youth voter turnout. And I hope that we're going to see certainly, the numbers already suggest that a lot of people have already voted in this election. And I think it is only good for our democracy when more people become involved and engaged.
I was relating the story earlier in the show about being at a local watering hole yesterday and again getting taken into those conversations about, you know, why can't we just have the facts? Why can't we just have somebody explain things, you know, and give us proper context? And I didn't bring it up there, but I wanted to bring it up for the show today here. I had the social media post Friday morning when the most recent job figures came out. And from one news outlet, it said the nation added 261,000 jobs, which shows that, you know, President Biden's plans are working. And the other said the country added 261,000 jobs, which shows President Biden's plans might not be working. And it's just so frustrating to see that when all we're looking for is just that context that does not depend on anything other than what's right in front of your eyes, what people are saying and doing. And that's what so many of your videos are, is this is what somebody like a Ron Johnson has said and done with nothing else other than that. And that should tell you all you need to know about what kind of a senator he is and would be.
Well, I think that at this particular moment in our politics and in our journalism, there is an excessive desire to appear to not be taking sides. And unfortunately, that extends to not taking sides between what is fact and what is not fact. So much of our political discussion over the past decade could just be resolved. Things that we know as fact. We're for I'm relieved that we're seeing a bit more in the coverage of the 2020 election, that outlets are less frightened to describe the former president's claims as lies, because they are. But that's the sort of thing that this is documentable. We don't have to say, well, I guess we don't know, this side saying this side saying that. No, one person got more votes, one person got fewer votes. We can disagree about whether it was the better candidate, but there's no ambiguity in the outcome of the election. And too often news outlets have just refused to do that for fear of looking partisan. Mm-hmm. And I think if anything, media needs to have a pro-democracy, pro-fact bias. That should be the bias that's in play. That is not a bad bias. And treating pro-democracy and anti-democracy forces and pro-fact forces and anti-fact forces as equally valid options is not good for the health of our society, and it's not actually good journalism.
Well, and when we talk about fact and what is a fact, your most recent video takes on one of those facts that, again, larger media outlets seem to not want to acknowledge, and that is what we mean when we say Democratic Party control of the Senate. That, you know, control is really, I mean, if ever a word were built for air quotes right now, it's the word control in terms of Democratic control of the Senate. And you lay out, you know, that it's much more than just, you know, two renegade, allegedly Democratic senators. There's a lot more at play here.
Well, I do think that a big failure, both in the way that political leaders have been talking about our politics and the way the journalists have, is there has not been sufficient explanation of the actual mechanics of how bills get passed and what prevents them from getting passed. I think most Americans tend to think of Congress as like a sporting event. And, oh, you know, if Democrats just played harder on any given day, the team that plays harder can win. But it's not. It's a matter of math. And so the filibuster, in its current form, we have come to accept the idea that almost nothing can move forward without 60 votes supporting it. That is not something that comes from the Constitution. That is not something that is deeply rooted in the history of our nation. It's really only since the Obama presidency that the filibuster has become a default position for all legislation. But I think that the media has failed to talk enough about it, and I think Democrats have failed to talk enough about it. I think a lot of people are disillusioned after voting in the last election, imagining that simply giving a nominal majority to Democrats would allow Democrats to pass whatever they wanted. But it's not the case. Republicans have been able to block hundreds of popular bills, and most people don't understand how or why that happened. I remember during the Obama presidency having a conversation with someone saying, well, why doesn't he do more to create jobs? And I say, oh, well, there was this great jobs bill that was just in the Senate, but it was defeated. I think it was 53-47. And they said, oh, 53 people voted against it. And I said, no, 53 senators voted for it. It was the 47 who voted against it who defeated it. And that's not just an offense against democracy. That's an offense against math. So we have this situation where people are frustrated because Democrats promised a lot of things, and the things that they promised got passed in the House. We saw passage of the Equality Act, which bans discrimination against LGBTQ Americans, raising the minimum wage, an assault weapons ban, paid family leave. These are all things that were able to pass in the House, and these are popular bills, most of which, if not all, could win a simple majority vote in the Senate. But because they couldn't get the 60 votes needed to even have a vote, they didn't go anywhere.
Right. And it's worth reminding people that Mandela Barnes has said, you know, he would vote to get rid of the filibuster, and that Ron Johnson, by using that filibuster, has blocked gun safety legislation for years. He tried to block the burn pit legislation that would have provided better health care to our veterans who served overseas and so forth. Another video you did recently reminded people not to be fooled on election night and in the coming day by what's known as the red mirage. This seems like a good time to tell all of our listeners about that as well. And again, there's nothing new about it. It's just the way the Republicans have twisted the way votes are counted to create this mirage, this false expectation.
Yes, this is something that's very important for people to know. So for a variety of reasons, Republican votes tend to get counted before Democratic votes. Most of the reasons for this are not in any way nefarious. Republicans tend to live in more sparsely populated areas and Democrats in more densely populated ones. The comparison I drew in the video is that Liberty County, Florida has, I think, fewer than 3,000 voters, and Broward County, Florida has nearly 2 million. So which of those counties do you think is going to finish counting its votes first? The one with the fewer votes to count. And so what happens is these smaller precincts, these smaller counties, they finish counting their votes, they report their results, and we see Republicans taking an early lead. And then later on into the night, or if the counting takes days, as it very well may, that lead closes. That doesn't necessarily mean that Democrats will overtake it in a given race. At no point am I saying in this video what I think the outcome of the election will be, because that's up to the American voters. But what is definitely the case is that an early lead by Republicans is unrelated to the final outcome. This is not surprising. People who've studied elections know it. The former political editor of Fox News testified about it to the January 6th committee. But in 2020, it was one of the main basis that Trump used to try to falsely claim that there had been election fraud. As he said, look, we were ahead to begin with, and then all of a sudden we fell behind. But there's nothing actually suspicious about it. It is to be expected. So whatever happens in Tuesday's elections, I don't know who's going to come out on top, who's not going to. But in the immediate hours after the closing of the polls, Republicans will appear to have a bigger lead than they ultimately will, regardless of who wins in the end.
We're talking to Alan Piper, national correspondent for Courier Newsroom. You see a lot of his videos on the Up North News social media sites, but I would urge everybody on Twitter to go to apiper13 for as long as there is still a Twitter, apparently, and you'll see you'll be able to see them more at a glance. We won't be able to get into some of the others, like explaining how when we talk about inflation, hey, let's talk for a bit about oil company gouging and the massive profits and so many other topics that Alan gets into. But in the couple of minutes we have left, I want to close with the January 6th committee, because you have put across a masterful series of summary videos for each of those hearings. And so I just wanted to give you some time in these final 2 minutes here just to kind of talk about your takeaway and or the takeaway that voters should get from what we saw throughout the course of the year, which might already seem like it's somewhere off in the distance, but it's not that far back when you consider the votes on Election Day are going to determine whether there's consequences for all this or not.
Absolutely. Well, in Wisconsin, it's particularly crucial, because one of the key things we learned in the January 6th hearings is that we heard evidence implicating Senator Ron Johnson in a plot to bring fake electoral votes into the House and attempt to hand them off to Vice President Pence. Fortunately, Vice President Pence was having no part of it. This is a scheme that the senator has been implicated in via testimony. He has refused to address the issue. It is the most, when I think about how the senator has been trying to run on crime as an issue, the most serious crime in a democracy that we could have is attempting to overturn that democracy. And so for the senator to be implicated in a plot to do exactly that is about as alarming as one can get.
And what else did you, I mean, do we look at that and say, well, those were some nice hearings, but you know, nothing can be done, or, you know, do voters still have it in their power to provide some consequences?
Voters absolutely have it in their power to provide consequences. And I'm not going to tell people how to vote, but I do think that if democracy is important to you, you need to vote for candidates who support democracy, even if they may not be the candidate that aligns with your policy issues. We all ought to be able to agree on supporting democracy. And we have hundreds of election deniers on the ballot, including Senator Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, who have taken a specific stance against democracy.
And it's one that, yes, democracy should be top of mind. Alan Piper, thank you for your time. We appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. We will be back to wrap up today's show after this. You're Up North. Living in America means living with the digital age that is all around us now, and that will be a little harder for 11,000 employees of Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp who are being laid off by Meta, the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, reducing their workforce by 13%. Again, more than 11,000 layoffs and extending a hiring freeze well into the next year. And along with all the other business notes, my other takeaway from this is they quote Mark Zuckerberg. And of course, the story says Zuckerberg, 38, attributed the cuts to growing too quickly during the pandemic, blah, blah, blah. I'm just back at Zuckerberg is 38, which I don't know how I feel about that. Part of me thinks he's still a teen, but yeah, he's also been there, you know, in the public consciousness for a very long time. So it's this 38-year-old who is continuing to try to drag America kicking and screaming into the metaverse. And look, despite these layoffs and these setbacks, we're only going to get more digital. There's always going to be a place for old school communications. You have to build off a base. And so that's why we're building this radio network, Civic Media, all across Wisconsin. It's why Up North News will always have a website and a good old-fashioned daily newsletter that you can subscribe to at our old-fashioned website, upnorthnewswi.com. Those things will be there. But our leadership has been very clear over at Courier Newsroom that Up North News needs to continue to press into delivering the news and delivering messages on social media. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, get on TikTok. And campaigns understand that. One thing I noticed over and over again, because I pull up a lot of clips on YouTube, and there were nearly no ads by or for Mandela Barnes, whereas the ads by or for Ron Johnson were almost ubiquitous with YouTube. Now, again, he was bankrolled by literal billionaires who wanted to continue to buy that seat and protect the tax breaks that Ron Johnson got for them. But the point remains, the digital space is also going to be extremely important in campaigns going forward. Doesn't mean it's always going to work right away. I would point to the 25th State Senate District where, you know, my friend Kelly Westland did a great job of making TikTok videos throughout the campaign. Now, she still fell short to Romaine Robert Quinn, 57-43% in that Northwest Wisconsin district that Janet Buley's retiring from. But she's doing the right things, getting on there and reaching folks. So there just aren't nearly as many people, you know, in Northwest Wisconsin on TikTok as there will be eventually on more of these digital platforms. And so it just is very important that campaigns, while they're going to feel spread thin, well, so are all of us. You know, there's almost never an important occasion that I don't watch on a double screen where I'm looking at the TV, but I might also be looking at what people are saying on Twitter about it or reading the live blog of some reporter who's following the State of the Union address or what have you. We're all going to be spread thin. Now, we don't, there are very few people that are going to listen to, you know, this particular radio station all day long. They're going to look at their phones or their tablets. And the message in one platform will not be the same message in another. You can't do one size fits all political ads, but you do have to have some common themes. And that's part of what Tom was talking about. It's part of what was in that New York Times analysis I read earlier, is that there needs to be those concise themes by a campaign. And in this case, for Democrats, it means that whether it's defending Joe Biden, should he choose to run for a reelection, or, you know, somebody else in that race, Tammy Baldwin, or somebody else in that race, and so forth, the work begins right now about looking at what do you want the 2024 results to be, and then how do you reverse engineer that? How do you get to where you want to go? Where will those voters be? What will be motivating them? And of course, we don't know all the answers right now. My goodness, nobody saw a pandemic that was coming until it was just upon us. But you have to start someplace, because then if the topic has to change, perhaps your messaging doesn't. Perhaps your theme doesn't. One that I saw emerge for progressives this year was about freedom. That this is about, you know, freedom to control your body and freedom to get an education without having to go to a private for-profit or religious voucher school. Freedom to vote. Those things are important. And I think Democrats might do well to stay on that, but to also anticipate what Republicans are going to be talking about in 2024 when they work, and the work will go on, to undermine faith in democracy, to undermine faith in elections. While Tony Evers was reelected, Republicans still control the legislature. And while they have a chance to grow up now and work with Governor Evers on some things, they're still going to pass bills that would, say, abolish the Wisconsin Elections Commission. And in doing so, you know, Janelle Branchen will chair the Assembly Elections Committee, most likely, and continue to have conspiracy theorists come in and all of that. And so Democrats will have to bear that in mind as they craft their own message going forward. But one can hope, if for nothing else, that come January, when Tony Evers is sworn into a second term, and when Republicans do get set to come back to work for the first time in nearly 10 months and run the legislature, there will be a surplus of more than $5 billion there. We know what Republicans wanted to do with it if Tim Michaels had won the race, basically give it all away in tax cuts and say, you can spend your money better, even though I don't fill potholes and I don't remodel schools and I don't inspect water systems for PFAS. That's what I want that surplus money to go toward, and with enough left over to reduce taxes. That kind of comprehensive plan on the surplus is going to be immensely critical. And I don't know who's going to be the leader on that, if it's going to be Robin Voss or if it's going to be some other members of the legislature that say, you know, we can't keep doing this. How about if we finally, after 4 years, confirm the rest of Tony Evers' nominees for various offices? And why don't we figure out how to get the win-win out of this and then go fight on other fronts? Because if you can't get a win-win deal out of a $5 billion surplus, well, you're just doing it wrong. And so that's one of the things that we need to see as we look ahead. Governor Evers has already put plans out there. It's time for Republicans to put up. They don't have Tim Michaels there where they can just try a one-size-fits-all tax cut. They actually have to write a plan. Let's see if they do. And let's see if they finally get off this Trump train, this big lie, and stop undermining faith in elections. The people have spoken. They did it fair and square. They did it loud and clear. And they did it in a way that only Wisconsin can. Continually, 50-50. Every vote matters. Your vote matters. Thanks for being with me today. We'll do it all again tomorrow. Work hard, play hard, and we'll meet you back here on Thursday. With your band, so-